Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
The people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy anything based solely on tip or recommendation you hear. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 459. On the podcast today, I have CEO of Satellite Solutions Worldwide, that's SAT ticker, Andrew Walwin, and he answers private investors' questions, and I'm annoyed, a little bit annoyed, actually. The last time on the podcast was the 14th of January. And I liked the story a lot. And it's one of those things where you're going to press the trigger to buy and you hesitate for a second. And all of a sudden, my attention span went elsewhere and I didn't buy. They were 4.5 pence then, now over 9 pence now. But do you know what? Still excellent potential here. And it still makes sense. And anyway, you'll hear that when I talk to Andrew there. Also on the podcast, market commentator with Admiral Markets UK's Darren Sinden. We talk about oil and just problems with the global economy. And I suggest that, and Darren sort of agrees as well, the big problem facing us, the big headwind facing us globally now is Britain. And their, you know, proposed Brexit. Because you remember a while back, the wobble the market had when Greece was going to leave the EU. And Greece is a tiny economy. It doesn't have any material effect on the whole EU. Now Britain, fifth largest economy in the world, is thinking of leaving the EU or is having a vote on it. And the uncertainty posed by this, you know, this vote, this referendum, will really send shockwaves through the entire EU community. That will really, you know, put the question in people's minds, is this EU, you know, situation, project working? Is it working? Also on the podcast, I have Doc Holliday, small cap commentator and authority there, talks about the following stocks: Metal Tiger, 88 Energy, Red Rock Resources, African Potash, Armadale Capital, and Charrick Gold. Plus, I have today's stock with potential. It's suggested by Sierra 117. It's Starcom Global, ticker STAR. And of course, I read out a review by someone who's given me a 5-star rating on iTunes. I do appreciate that.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chief Executive Officer of Satellite Solutions Worldwide. That's SAT ticker. It's Andrew Walwin. You all right, Andrew?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for having us on again.
Yeah, well, do you know, I'm gutted because the last time you came on, I really liked the story, what your business, what you're doing. You know, it's obviously got a need to fill there and people in rural areas. We'll go through exactly what you do. But I was looking at the stock price and I thought at the time it was sort of flatlining a bit. And I thought, should I get in and wait for a little dip maybe? Because I was really into it. And I waited, and that was, you know, that's punished me. Because now at the time it was like 4.5 pence and now you're over 9 pence. So I've got to double my money there between podcasts. So you must be quite pleased with the stock price performance, yeah?
We are, Justin, yeah. I mean, the fact that it's going in the right direction is great. I think I probably touched on last time, you know, we're still relatively new as a public business. We haven't been listed for a year yet. So I think some of it is people becoming more aware of us, and I guess there's a bit of catch-up in the share price there. But yes, obviously, we are happy that it's heading in the right direction.
Okay, for people who didn't hear that podcast, Andrew, can you go through exactly what you do?
really, we supply broadband to people who've got slow or no broadband. So if you, I guess our target market is anyone who's got a broadband speed less than 2 meg. Or, you know, that is really it, because satellite broadband, we come along, put a dish on the side of your house or your office. Your modem's exactly the same as, say, a TalkTalk or a BT one. And that's going to give you speeds of above 20 meg. And, you know, it's transformational. You don't have your buffering, you know, your whirring circle or anything like that. And typically, you know, that is... if we just look at the European marketplace for a second, there's 20 million households or premises in that situation across the whole of Europe. So yeah, that is our marketplace.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you're not alone in, you know, in fighting this battle to get people on an equal playing field, because the government as well, haven't they, have said that, you know, it's not acceptable. Rural areas can't get speeds, you know, but above 10 megabits. So they're helping out as well, aren't they?
They are. So the UK government joined in the fight in December of last year. There's currently three or four different subsidy schemes running throughout the UK at the moment. If I'm honest, I think the Welsh scheme is definitely the easiest to use. They are being the most supportive, not just financially, but the actual process. It's very easy for people to redeem that. The schemes, the general schemes in England and Scotland, are a little bit harder to process. But what it's doing, it's meaning that, you know, it's no longer unfair for certain people living in rural areas. They're not being punished by not being able to access fast broadband. So, you know, very, it's supportive, and obviously we're very fond of that.
Yeah, and of course. I mean, you know, the internet now has gone from being in a pastime, a fad, to something that's actually needed for business. So it's good that this incentive. So what happens? I mean, is it a case of if a business, you know, is in a rural area, how do they get this? Because doesn't the government pay for the equipment? Is that the case?
Yeah, under the grant scheme, they log on with their local council. There's certain forms to fill in. That is then processed and checked, and you know, it varies from scheme to scheme, but eventually they're given a code which they can then redeem with ourselves. We turn out, you know, we install within 10 days and they're all up and running. The customer no longer has any upfront costs whatsoever under the schemes.
Okay, marvellous. Well, let's go through some private investor questions. And your name suggests you are worldwide, but someone has suggested here, what is the potential size of your market?
Well, I mean, at the moment, Satellite Solutions Worldwide, that's who we are. In Europe, we trade under the brand of EuropaSat. And as I mentioned slightly earlier, you know, there's 20 million households or premises across the whole of Europe. Currently, we bill in... just over 30 of the European countries. So that is quite a strong market in itself. But for us, you know, we're in a way, we're following technology. We don't actually launch or fly the satellites. Those are the satellite operators. So what we do is we tend to look at where is the new technology satellites going up, and then we look to see the timescales on that. So it isn't just a focus on Europe. As new satellites go up around the world, so recently some were launched in Australia, for instance, a KA satellite in Australia, and they will come online quite soon. So, you know, there is opportunities worldwide.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And is, you know, other governments are supportive of this kind of, as our government, or are our government behind in this, or what?
So our government's probably, let's be fair there. They're behind some and ahead of others. Okay. The country that's probably been the most advanced in supporting satellite broadband is France. I guess it is a slightly geographically a larger area, and the population is more sparse. So our product fits very well there. France is regularly updating the support and the number of people that they will supply. Poland is a government, or the country is saying that they will start supporting this year. But I mean, there's the overall commitment of the European Union that by 2020, everyone has to have a broadband speed above 2 meg. So the only way that can happen across the whole of Europe is to use satellite broadband. And indeed, you know, the EU has recognised that.
Yeah, well, that must be quite exciting for you, because obviously the current is going in your direction, I suppose. But, OK, there's another question here, and you sort of touched on it. Can you describe the customer journey from having poor broadband to getting you guys on board?
Yes, yeah, so the first thing is they're probably going to find out about satellite broadband. I mean, the one thing that the grant schemes are doing across Europe is it's making people more aware about the product, that there is something other than just sitting there, you know. They've been told they can't get fibre, so what can they get? And the awareness is a big thing. And then they'll approach us either online or through call centres. We're in some rural retailers. There's local partners, often that, you know, the people who know that area very, very well. And then they will place an order through us directly or one of these other channels. And the customer then has a simple choice. They either go for a sort of professional install, and normally we say we'll have a customer install within 10 days, or they install it themselves. It's quite a simple product. The dish is a little bit bigger than, say, a Sky dish, and it's not that difficult to install. It depends, actually, if you're a DIY enthusiast. Typically, something like 80% of Germans self-install. Why us Brits prefer to get others to do it. But
I love that stat, because that does fit with the, you know, Germans as we've seen them, really. I got to say, I would have no idea. DIY, I would get somebody in, I think, because I'd probably install it on the wrong side of the house, upside down, all kind of things. So that's good. But essentially, so you've got, you know, the government's there almost, you know, raising awareness, doing a bit of marketing for you. And obviously there's incentive to buy, to help them as well. So it's a good thing, isn't it?
It is. It is definitely a good thing. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Okay, let's go with the next question. What is your priority for this year?
I think it's continue to drive growth. I mean, whether that's through acquisitions or the organic growth, you know, we've set a target at the end of 2017 of 100,000 customers. You know, we're on track to do that. And that has got to be the focus, the main focus. Mm-hmm. We also want to look at how we broaden, you know, increase our margins and revenue, and looking at how we can sell in incremental products. So offering telephone services, other business products. These have, you know, been launched earlier in the year, and penetration levels of those have got to grow as well.
Yeah, well, the next question is quite relevant, but I don't know of anyone listed, you know, another company that does this. So it says, who are your competitors?
So in Europe, there isn't actually a direct competitor. In each of the Europe, well, not in each of the European, but in some of the European countries, there will be a distributor of some form that will be specializing in the product, but no one who has the reach across the whole of Europe with our systems and our pricing. No, so we don't have a direct competitor.
Wow. Okay, are you planning any more acquisitions?
We've got a very strong pipeline. We're talking to people all the time. And obviously, to hit our 2017 numbers, there's got to be some more acquisitions involved.
Okay, next question. You sort of touched on this anyway. Aside from the UK, which EU countries offer subsidies, or do you expect it to do in the near term?
Sorry, yeah. So France is definitely the market leader on that. You know, the government there is very behind it. In fact, I think in December, they set aside funding for another 100,000 households. You know, that's a real chunky number that they're getting behind. And I know that Poland, the Polish government is saying that they will launch something this year.
Okay, and you mentioned the next question is asked about your target, your 2017 target for 100,000 customers. And you said that's the aim, and you're on course for that.
We are, yeah. I mean, I think it's considerably larger than we finished last year with. But you know, with the scale and our systems, yeah, that is achievable, and we're on track.
Okay, do you need to raise any more funds in the short term?
You know, we're always talking to people. You know, our acquisition pipeline's there, and I think, you know, when the time is right, we will. I think you've got to remember the management own 30% of the business. Mm-hmm. So we're never going to rush to dilute. Mm-hmm. It's only if it's going to be right to go out and raise more funds, will we? But at some time in the future, yes, that will happen as sizable acquisitions come along.
Yeah, and that's always good to know. I mean, whenever someone asks me what I look for in a company, you know, management having skin in the game is always an important thing because, like I said, they are aligned with other shareholders. Because so often, though, you do see quite a few AIM companies, you know, and the management have hardly any shares at all. And you think, well, hang on, they're just getting paid, they don't care. But obviously, that's not the case here. Okay, next question is, what is your ambition for the company?
I think really to change us from just being European focused to having a much more global influence. I think I touched on earlier about the fact that new satellites are going up around the planet, and we have the technology and the systems to follow those, where we sit between the actual network operator, the guy who flies it, and the end user customer. And I think there is a real opportunity for us in some other parts of the world.
Okay, the last question here. We mentioned the government's support scheme, but how much has it helped you?
Well, at the moment, how would I word it? We have lots of potential. I think I touched on some of the processes are actually, there's lots of customers who've applied to get the grant. And at the moment, that's all caught up in red tape. We're beginning to see some of those initial applications that were put in January actually being connected, but there is quite a long lead time having to go through that scheme. And you know, we're working closely with BDUK in you know, England and Scotland to try and improve those schemes so that it's not such a challenge for the customers to come online.
Okay, but even without that, I mean, you are doing very well. Is that the case? Or?
Yeah, I mean, organic sales continue to rise and our overall performance, you know, month on month is growing.
Okay, I want just a question from me. So price-wise, is it comparable to, you know, normal sort of broadband?
Yes, I mean, our typical customer pays somewhere around £30 to £40 a month. And if you look at a typical, in the UK, just talking UK for a second, BT or TalkTalk, you know, you're paying somewhere between £15 to £17 a month for your landline, and then you've got your broadband on top of that. So it is very much in line with the average household. So the point of actual the subsidy in the UK, you know, the setup costs of which is around £200 to £300, which is subsidised by the government. You know, it makes it very fair. All of a sudden, the ongoing costs are the same, and your speeds are greatly improved.
Okay, marvellous. That's the questions, Andrew. And if, you know, if you need to convince anyone or any, you know, potential investor to put you on their watch list, could you give us three reasons why they should do this?
I think the first thing is that if you're going to get involved with any business, you want to know that they've got something to sell that people need. And overall, the demand for the internet is growing, you know, in whatever we do. And the demand for speed is continually there. What we've got is a product that does that for households that cannot get fast broadband. So we've got a product there. We've also got this drive, more and more, whether it's business, individuals have to use the internet. The fact that if you're a farmer, you've got to put all your animals online. If you're a school kid, which I've got three boys, everything from my maths, everything is all used online. I suppose the final point is management. You know, we've been doing this for, we're in our eighth year. So although we've only been listed for coming up for 12 months in May, you know, we've been doing it for a long time. And you know, we're really behind the business and make sure it's not off and on AIM. Some of the businesses come and go. Ours is all about, we came to the market to raise funds, to accelerate the growth of our business. That's what's happening, and we will continue to do that.
Yeah, and like I said, you have skin in the game yourself. And also, that's true about the speed of the internet. As, you know, websites and programs get more complex and have more data to transfer, we need more and more speed. And I think we'll look back in about 10 years' time and think, was that all you had on the internet, the speed-wise, you know? Because, like I said, everything gets more sophisticated, doesn't it? And also, I read that some companies will probably use you as a backup service as well to their broadband. Is that right?
It is. I mean, there's two points there. The first point is if you look at where speed is going in satellite, some of our packages now are 30 meg, which even if you go back 2 or 3 years ago, you wouldn't have dreamt of that on satellite. People are now talking by 2018, 2019, our speeds will be sitting around 50 to 100 meg down, which is absolutely unbelievable. So that's evolving at a much faster rate than the mobile phone networks ever did. So, you know, speed is king. That is what people want. But also the backup side, we're really seeing that. Yeah, if a company goes down, if their internet goes down, everyone's just sitting there now because most of the things are in the cloud. They grind to a standstill. Their systems, their phones often, are all voice over IP. So what we have is systems that kick in people can continue until the internet comes back up. Because most normal companies will have a backup of some form, but even if it's with two different providers, they're still using the same fiber coming into that building. So so long as there's electricity, we'll be able to provide the internet.
Yeah, so the money wasted on that downtime when they can't do anything, you know, they could have spent on having a backup, exactly. In fact, even a tiny proportion of that money wasted, you know, could be paid for the backup, I suppose. Marvellous. Andrew, thank you very much for coming on. And listen, I look forward to you coming on again very soon.
Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is a market commentator with Admiral Markets UK. It's Darren Sinden, or at Fat Daz on Twitter. You all right, Daz?
Yeah, very well, thank you, Justin. I hope you are too.
Yeah, not too bad. Now, of course, I did look at Twitter and everything on Sunday evening, yesterday evening, to check out the results of what happened in Doha. And not a lot, it seems. It was a no-go-ha in Doha, wasn't it?
It was. As far as I understand it, the Iranians didn't even bother to turn up. The Saudis obviously weren't prepared to enter into any agreement that didn't include the Iranians. And for obvious reasons, the Iranians are not looking to curb their supply. They're only just now being allowed back into world markets officially, so they're keen to pump as much oil as they can to make up for what they see as lost time. But to be honest, I think you'd have to have been an eternal optimist anyway to have expected a positive outcome, because many of the people that sat round, or were sitting around the table in Doha, are actually fighting a proxy war against each other in Syria by backing, you know, different factions there. So it's hard to imagine, you know, agreeing on oil production when you're supplying weapons to rival factions in a civil war. So leaving that to one side, oil prices obviously dropped sharply this morning. I see they've retraced some of their losses, but nonetheless they're still trading down. What I find interesting as well is if we look further out, it is with some of the bigger moves that we saw in oil are actually for delivery dates in 2017. It's not going to go away, basically. I think the thing to bear in mind now is that we should start to watch the supply side metrics again. So US crude inventories on Wednesday, the Baker Hughes rig count that comes out on a Friday, that data is going to start becoming more and more important. No, it wasn't important before, but it just takes on an extra focus because as you say, a no-show in Doha, and not much chance of getting all, you know, the parties back round the table again in the near future.
Yeah, and I was reading anywhere, a couple of bits of news from the IEA, you know, International Energy Agency, was saying now they're thinking that it'll balance itself, supply demand will balance itself towards the end of the year for some reason. So I think fundamentals there are looking good for oil anyway. When I saw this on Sunday night, I thought nothing's going to happen here, and there was no agreement. I thought we will have a sharp sell-off initial reaction, and I did think this may come back, because reading those reports last week, but on the IEA says anyway, and I don't think you should, you know, meddle with them. I know they're pumping like crazy, and Saudi sort of are, you know, they've got this battle on. I don't know whether it's true to take out the North American shale producers, it seems to be working. If you look at the charts of that, and like you said, the rig count, it is going down drastically,
well,
isn't it?
Well, the rig count is going down, but here's the flip side to that. First of all, with the IA, they also said that they thought that the price of WTR would settle somewhere around $34.70 in that area. Forgive me if that's not the exact figure. Secondly, about the rig count, yes, the numbers of rigs are going down in the US, but the flip side to that is that if you look at the picture in Saudi Arabia, they've actually got a record number of rigs out prospecting for further oil in the kingdom there. So yeah, there's a downturn in the States, but there doesn't seem to be any sign of a downturn in exploratory action in the Middle East. And also, it's probably worth pointing out that just because the shale guys maybe go offline temporarily, the people in the Gulf of Mexico, the offshore production there, can step in to fill that breach. So it's a very confusing picture, Justin, but I still think the supply side is stronger than the demand side at the moment, and so therefore we can expect prices to drift a bit further, in my opinion, over the medium term.
Yeah, well, I've noticed one of my holdings, Royal Dutch Shell, was down about over 3% this morning, and now it's, like I said, it's come back and it's only 1.6% down. But it's still a nice uptrend, you know, and it's almost got the golden cross happening on the chart, so it's showing, you know, positive signs.
If you're going to be in an oil name, you may as well be in a quality name like Shell. There's obviously a slight question mark over the dividend longer term if prices don't bounce back. But having said that, you know, the price of oil has fluctuated, you know, dramatically over the lifetime of a company like Shell, and in truth, it's in the business of adjusting its business model to reflect what is a volatile commodity. So, it's to some extent, it's water of the ducks back to them longer term. And, you know, investors have got faith and a strong enough stomach, then they'll probably be okay longer term.
I like that little analogy, did they? Water of the ducks back. Because the reason why water runs on a duck's back is because of the oils it produces.
Certainly is. Certainly is.
So there we are. All right, anything else you think you're looking at, Daz?
Okay, well, talking about individual sectors and things where there might be a change. One chart that has struck me today is it came really from looking at where we were year to date on a sector basis, and if we look for what are the best performing sectors in the UK this year, FTSE 350 mining is pretty much at the top of the tree. Mm. Year to date, as of the close of Friday, they're up. The miners are up collectively by just over 34%.
Wow.
And if we flip that around and we look for the laggard, the sector that's performed the worst, then we alight on the UK banking sector. And again, as of Friday night, these were down just a little under 15%. So you've got a massive divergence between those two sectors. Now, I run the investors intelligence model, and that's been useful in that you can overlay many of these things onto a single chart and do so in a couple of different ways. So the chart I've plotted is the difference between the FTSE 350 mining sector and the FTSE 350 banking sector. And it seems to me that we're approaching something of a topping out point, as it were, where it might be right to look to fade the miners to buy the banks. Now, against that, of course, it's quite difficult to make a fundamental case for buying the banks as a whole. Although we were talking about this just before we came on air about Asian facing banks, and I've just got the chart of HSBC up, and they had some very interesting price action over the last week. A big bounce on the 13th of April, and they've come back to resistance. So that could be an interesting proxy. But more than looking for a fundamental reason to perhaps consider this trade, I think the reason to look at it, or at least keep an eye on it, is the idea that that fund managers are always on the lookout for contrarian trades to put money into sectors that they think perhaps have fallen too far too fast and now should recover, and on the flip side of that, to take a profit or to in some cases go short a sector that they think has overextended. So the miners could fit that latter category. They possibly could be thought of as being overextended, and the banks down 14, nearly 15% over the year. Perhaps that's a big enough fall for them, given that they've been in a downtrend for some time anyway. So
yeah,
certainly food for thought there, I think.
Yeah, well, definitely. Do you know what? Even technically, it seems to be playing out that theory of, you know, like you said, they rotate their funds there from overbought to oversold a bit. And because I was looking at Standard Chartered and took a bite of this at initially at 470. And I bought some more a little bit lower down. And because there's a double bottom there, and I thought if it goes below that, about 380 rather, about there. If it goes below that, I'm wrong completely. But, even with this couple of bad down days we've had since I bought them, it's not retested that. And there's a nice little channel going upwards. And the top of the channel, it's sort of hitting that at 520. If it ends above that, that's very bullish. But, I mean, even the bottom of the channel is around about 440.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Technically, like I said, fundamentally, doesn't seem right, but technically, it looks very good here, you know?
Yeah, I saw another interesting snippet on Twitter today, which was a chart of how fund managers are positioned in emerging markets. And obviously, that plays, into the likes of Standard Chartered and HSBC. And very interestingly, there are big overweights in emerging markets such as India, where I believe there's, Standard Chartered still has a reasonable presence. So, and I think there people are looking for a resurgence in the domestic economy in some of these emerging markets rather than anything that's export-led. But just, the demographics of a place like India is growing fast. The population is clawing its way out of poverty. There's much like China, a large, aspiring middle class. And eventually those numbers just filter through into positive outcomes for the domestic economy. So there are lots of reasons to think that this might, this trade-off between selling the miners, buying the banks could be one to look at. I think we need to, watch it closely would be my advice. And then, if you start to see it move in the right direction, then maybe consider getting more involved.
Yeah, well, here's my theory. For a long time, a while back, do you remember all the worries about Greece? And then all of a sudden people started saying, there's whispers about China. And people said, this is the economy you need to look at. If anything's got upset, global trade, then it's going to be China. And now we've had Chinese GDP out last week, 6.7%. There were pockets of growth there, not in the traditional manufacturing side, but other areas. And I genuinely think now it's not going to be China that upsets the global economy. I think it's going to be back to Europe. I think it's going to be Britain on the leave, possibly. Then we'll have a problem with Greece as well. And altogether, this will impact, come together and think, well, hang on, is Europe, a viable sort of project? I think it will start unravelling. And over summer as well, when there's less liquidity, I think this will upset the markets more than any data from China. I don't know what your thoughts on that is.
Well, I am a China bear, but it doesn't really matter what I think. It's what the market thinks as a whole. And as we saw, that China GDP data and the balance of trade data we had recently, both were greeted with a positive response. And that sort of accounts for the big leap, for instance, that we talked about in HSBC. It's interesting that you turn the spotlight back onto Europe, though, because I'm writing a couple of articles last week about sort of allied topics, one of which was about volatility, and I chanced upon a report from Bloomberg about FX volatility. I won't go too much into that because it's quite technical. Basically, 3-month risk is being priced more steeply than 12-month risk, and the last time that happened, or commonly happened across a basket of currencies, was back in 2010 at the height of the Greek crisis, when there was a genuine question mark over the future of the euro. So whilst we're perhaps not quite at that situation yet, and since the euro survived that, it probably survives the next blow. But there are plenty of things. I went through then listed half a dozen different things that are on the horizon. The US election, China slowdown, negative rates, what it means for Europe, the Greek situation still unresolved, the Italian banking sector, constantly needing triage. And if you put all these things together, then there is, a bit of a wall of worry for European investors to climb. You rightly mentioned Brexit, of course, as a concern. And that obviously any that also feeds back into my comments earlier. Yes, of course, anyone making any investment decisions in the UK has got to consider that very carefully. Obviously, we've still got 9-10 weeks to the referendum, and the polling is sort of neck and neck, 50-50. So there is a window still to perhaps put on a few trades. But equally, the FT, was suggesting that today that investors are starting to to be a bit more cautious towards putting on trades in the UK, just because of the perception that there will be some instability. There hasn't particularly been any at the moment, you know, on a grand scale so far. But I think the perception is that the closer we get to the 23rd of June, you know, the more volatility might show its hand.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I mean, and sort of last point in here, is that, do you know, look how volatile the markets were on the Greek problem when everyone was saying, in fact, and everyone knew the Greek economy doesn't have that much of a bearing anyway on the economy of Europe, but it's still threw a spanner into the works. Now, we're talking about Britain, the fifth largest economy pretty much in the world, thinking of leaving. Now, yeah. If the Greek economy managed to throw a wobbler into the European sort of economy, then imagine Britain leaving. Of course it will. It will tear apart the whole idea of Europe, you know? And I think it's Britain, not China, that will be causing the problems in the next few months.
I think that's a very sensible and well-argued point, to be honest. And I think it also flags the point that a lot of the media coverage to date has been about the implications for Britain if it leaves the EU. And there's been a lot less focus on the other way around, i.e. the focus, you know, the concerns for the EU, as you just highlighted, if Britain were to leave. And perhaps that's, you know, as you just identified, perhaps that's the gorilla in the room, shall we say, rather than, you know, than the effect of Brexit on the UK per se.
Yeah, marvellous. All right, any other thoughts, Daz, or...
Well, you know, we've got the ECB, haven't we, on Thursday. That's obviously one of the big events this week. And I can't imagine that they're going to say anything other than, you know, it's as you were, probably a hint at further easing, even if they don't actually take any action. So more of the same. And obviously people quizzing Draghi quite hard in the press conference after. It's a relatively quiet week for data apart from that. We've got some balance of trade data from Japan to come tomorrow, I believe. I'll be at the Reserve Bank of Australia interest rate meeting tomorrow too, and at the end of the week, US jobless claims, the Philly Fed survey, always important to look at that, and PMI manufacturing in the States. I'm concerned about the state of US manufacturing, so I'll be watching that data quite closely. Yeah, I mean, there's always something to look at in the markets, Justin. That's what makes it such an interesting place to be.
Exactly. It's all a big game, so that's why you should never risk your shirt, because you want to be able to still play the game. You know?
Yes, you do. Yeah. Capital preservation is everything.
Yeah,
so.
Marvellous. Daz, lovely to speak to you. Speak soon.
Thank you. Take care.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Wade.
And joining me on the podcast right now is small cap commentator, stroke authority, it's Doc Holliday. You're right, Doc.
Hello, Justin. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah. Listen, let me ask you a question, right? Because I notice on Twitter, you get some people, you know, having a bite to you, taking a chunk out of you sometimes, and you know, taking a chunk back. And essentially, it's when companies have, you know, rallied very strongly or something, and you believe they're, say, overvalued, and some people say, you're just saying this because you've got a short position, and I know you don't, because it's very hard to short, you know, small AIM companies. So, you know, and people get emotional because they're attached to their money and stuff. So why do you, for example, tweet or talk about a company you're not involved in that you see as overvalued, knowing it'll probably get the heckles up on some people? Why do you do that?
Well, I guess ultimately what we've got to look at is, you know, commenting in the market. Back in the very, very early days, I would only ever really ever talk about a company I was invested in. I then went on and started to look at companies that look quite flawed in the makeup. There's a level of corruption. I remember commenting on a company called US Oil and Gas, probably 4 years ago now, back in 2012. A kind of trading buddy of mine back then, he asked me, you know, would you come into this? I think it was a Google chat group at the time. They just launched this kind of little facility, and there was people talking about stocks, and they said, you know, what do you think about it? And I kind of said to him, well, you know, looking at it, I see all of this equity that's been issued to directors for a euro. That 1 euro of stock for 1 million shares at the time that they were issuing to directors was worth something like 6 million euros or something like that at the time. So I said, you know, this is crazy. They're just issuing the huge amounts of stock. There's huge amounts of stock entering the market, yet everybody's a buyer. There's something not quite right. And then naturally, once I give an opinion, that was met with a great deal of, you know, unhappiness. And back then, I had no interest in the company. But I just found it quite, you know, amazing that people would ask for an opinion opinion. And when you break it down and start to look at things, you know, the assets didn't look that they were operating in was relatively dry historically for oil, and there just seemed to be lots of different problems. So that was it really. Then I entered into a world where if you gave any opinion that didn't quite meet what people wanted you to say rather than expected, you know, you would get this response. And you know, you look at it now in a bigger picture, and people will always be unhappy if you give any opinion which is against the one they hold, where money's concerned, that they're invested in. I went into this becoming a writer. I worked with various different people over the last kind of few years. I wrote about 85% of stocks that I never ever invested in, and I would say probably the same percentage, 80 to 85%, were bullish articles that I published. So I would sit and I would pen an article and I would write about a company like you know, whoever it may have been, Shanta Gold or somebody at the time, and I'd look at, you know, what the production was going to be and everything else, and it would be quite easy to see that it, you know, it stacked up and it looked to be a good company. I was never invested, and I went on and did that over and over again. That was what I was out there doing. I was commenting on companies as a market commentator, blogger, etc. So I find it, you know, it doesn't really bother me, just in the truth. If people like or dislike what I say, it's what I've done for a long, long period of time now. I don't have any short position in the market against these companies. If I did, I would happily state it. The only short positions I take are predominantly industry shorts and stuff like that against generally the FTSE as well. I often will only stick within the realms of what I understand.
Yeah, and I suppose even if you did have a, you know, short position against these companies, then there would be a reason for that. And, you know, that reason is basically, but you're not, so it's a good thing. So I know a couple of stocks, like, for example, 88 Energy and Metal Tiger, the two I've seen people, you know, having a go at it with you on Twitter and stuff. And I know 88 Energy's come back a bit. But what people don't understand, I mean, with a market cap of, like, well, 100 million 88 Energy, you alone are not going to bring that share price down. And I think it's nice to have a balanced view, because I understand people who hold a stock have a biased view. I have that about all stocks I hold. I, you know, held Metal Tiger when you were having a go saying it's overvalued. And I just welcome that, because I think, it's an extra bit of research that, you know, I haven't considered, because I'm biased in holding the stock. And we should all know that. We're a little bit biased when we hold a stock. Oh, so absolutely. We need to have the other side, you know?
Absolutely. And the thing what we have to understand as well is, you know, it's important. One of the things I've promoted for a long, long period of time, years and years, in fact, is understanding market mechanics. For me, it's imperative for people to be able to kind of get, you know, drill the well and get their own water. We're not out here just to provide them with a bottle of something to drink, and when it's run out, then the mouth goes dry again. We've got to be able to, as people who are going to participate in this market, you've got to understand what makes it tick. And you can't get that from just following these kind of momentum events that take place in the market or all of the hype. You've got to understand exactly where it was born and where it's going to go. And when it gets to that point or somewhere near, you should take some, certainly protect capital, and you should look to take some of those profits when they're presented. You know, all too often we hear of people blowing their accounts up, losing all of the money or vast majority of it, so much so that they take years or never are able to get their losses back. So it's for me, it's something that's personal to me. I accept that some people may not like it. I also accept that perhaps I'm a nuisance or a noise in the background. What a lot of people forget is I penned an article before Christmas, time to take a punt on 88 Energy at half a penny. So when it's gone from half a penny to the upside, I mentioned to de-risk the capital. That's the obvious thing. I would do that myself. And I advise people to do the same. And when it got to like 2.75p and beyond, to me, it was just ludicrous. And at that point, you know, you've got to clear the decks. Now we've seen the price come off hard. We're sub 2p. They need to raise cash. The company have stated in their announcement, although sometimes you have to dig and sift through it, that they're going to probably, you know, be out there looking for additional cash. The figures that they presented and the amount of money that they were attributing to them shows that there's a deficit. They need to get that covered. How will they do it? An equity issue. strategy of some sort is coming. And, you know, the market is now starting to accept or understand that. The price is reacting. We get back to Metal Tiger. I talked to Paul Johnson on a regular basis when they couldn't get half a dozen trades a day through the book. One of the things that I've commented on is I felt the company had got a really bright future, and when it catches on, it'll do well. It's gone on, it's done well, and I think the responsible thing to say is, okay, it's up 5-6 times its multiple, it's ridiculous valuation now. They've been investing a couple of £100,000 here and there, and these assets are now, I've got a valuation that's, you know, just insane in my mind. And on that basis, not only would I say you should be de-risking, but you should be clearing the decks there, because if you've got 4 or 5p for stock you're buying at a penny or below, and you look at the valuation of the company, you look at their assets, and you look at the current cash position, if they want to fast-track these mining assets, they're very, very early stage, so if they want to really speed that process up, they're going to need cash to do it. And if they don't come and get a big slug of cash, then they're going to do it incrementally, and it's going to take longer. Either way, the expectation's not going to be met.
Yeah. It's sort of, you know, in analogous terms, it's almost like seeing a marathon runner there just sprint off like crazy, and you know, and he's gone too far, too fast, you know, and sooner or later he's going to have to either stop or really slow down, you know, and that's the share price consolidating essentially, and that's what's happening now, you know, with 8th Energy. It's really has gone too far. I mean, there's obviously potential there, huge potential, but there's a lot of things to go through before they get to that, isn't it? And you know, it has to come back a little bit. And like, if, oddly enough, you did say last time on the podcast, I said, where would you buy 8th Energy at? You said 1p, and now it's at 1.9, so it's, and at the time it was 3p, so you know, it is coming back towards that place. Anyway, let's talk.
Well, you know, the one thing that just before I go, because it is important, we touched the subject, so we might as well try and get, you know, just wind it up, is there's no personal feeling from me. There's no emotion involved at all. It may appear so when there's certain exchanges, but there's literally no emotion in anything I do with the stock market these days. Very few, far between will these occasions come where it becomes something that's a really emotional thing. It's one of the things that stifles us as people who are investing and trading in the markets. So it's important not to rely on your emotions too much. You know, if I say something and it upsets people, then, you know, I can only apologise for it. But if there's a lesson that people can learn from that, from understanding, you know, that how many companies have released 46, 47 RNSs historically? Okay, well, I don't think there's many that I know of on AIM, but we know that Metal Tiger are one. I think Red Rock Resources did it back in 2010. They had a colossal rise. LGO Energy did it 2013. Nowhere near as many RNSs, but they put out a baker's dozen in about 2 weeks. So, you know, these companies that have really gone out there and actively been promoting and driving the interest to their stock over the, you know, the course of time, unfortunately have not performed that well, and there's not many companies that have done it. So all of these factors have to be considered. It's no good just saying I like the director, so I'm just going to leave my money there, because there'll be people out there who are a bit more cutthroat, who will, you know, use a different kind of logic or understanding. They'll have a different concept of what's really going on, and they'll say, you know what, that's just too much to be leaving on the table. If I don't take it, somebody else will. And then when it starts to slip, everybody hopes that it'll come back, and unfortunately just all too often it doesn't happen. We do get the freaks of nature. We get companies that go on there and they'll do 100 and 200 times the multiple. I genuinely hope that happens for both Metal Tiger and 88 Energy at some point. But we're working on law of averages, statistics, trying to have a robust set of principles that work for us. And to do that, we've got to be more disciplined, and you can't be if you're letting things run without considering where the risk lies.
Okay, cool. Okay, let's go bullish now. So name a couple of stocks, maybe three maximum, that you have an interest looking at and you like.
Well, obviously, the last time we spoke, we talked a little bit about African Potash. Would that company do, you know, and I've got no position in African Potash at this point in time. You know, will it do well? You know, can Chris Cleverly get the news that the market expects? And we've seen that perk up yet again today. We're a lot closer, one would assume, to news now than perhaps we have been before. So I would naturally think that if it breaks that Chris Cleverly has brought home a payment that the market's anticipating, or better, they improve on that, then I think you're going to see things move along quite nicely for them too.
Okay. Anyone else?
Yeah, of course. One of the companies that I've actually been looking at, I have a position in. It's not a big one. It's more of a pilot position, based around the fact that there's a lot of doubt on this company, whether they can build at that level of interest and traction, is Armadale Capital ACP. It was tough.
Yeah.
When they raised some cash at 4p, I took part in that raise. I was interested to see what the company were going to do. There was a lot of people speculating back then, but the gold environment, certainly the mining environment, wasn't so great. So I think on that particular position, I saw a relatively good return in those markets at that point in time, and I just took it. Re-entered at 2.88p. Shares have been tickling under that 3p level down to 2.5p since they raised additional finance at 3 pence. You know, there's not a lot of liquidity. There's not a lot of traction there. There's not a great deal of interest. But as with Aletco and some of the other companies that I've been big supporter of that have performed particularly well, I think Armadale, if they can answer the concerns of investors, that's got a right old run to go on that one. And Charat Gold. Charat Gold, I'm not an investor in as of yet either. It's one of these things that it's got a huge resource in this definitive feasibility study. They've released some of the highlights. I think there's between years 4 and 11, they've got up to 200,000 ounces. Again, a few things to consider. Very low liquidity. If you're buying into that one more so than Armadale, you've got to be prepared to buy and hold, because there's not much work, you know, there's not much of a route out if you change your mind. But if these things catch on, they'll do well, because these are two companies that haven't had any kind of a run to the upside, tracking the interest in mining stocks and tracking gold. So at the minute, my task is to try and find companies that are in a hot space, that are in a hot commodity environment, that just are cold and stone cold. So there's two of them. I'm sure one will come good. They may both. Let's wait and see. But there's two to take a look at. One I'm invested in and one I'm not, but certainly track it.
Marvellous. Doc, speak soon, fella.
Cheers, thanks, Justin.
Okay, today's stock with potential, as suggested by Sierra 117. Thanks for getting involved here, fella. Or lady. I don't know who it is. Could be a lady or a fella. It's Starcom Global. Star is the ticker. That's a good ticker code, isn't it? What does the company do? It's got a huge range of GPS tracking systems. Personal, vehicle, shipping cargo, air cargo, etc., etc. How many shares does the company have in issue? 136 million. That's quite nice. I always like to see small caps, market caps. I mean, some people say, don't even worry about the shares in issue. I like to see a low free float, because then, you know, people can shift that low free float quite easily. And when the shares have been bought up, supply and demand, essentially, you can move the share price. What's the current price and market cap of the company? It's 3.4 million. 2.5 pence. Let me just check the chart. Let's check in the chart now and type in Starcom. Starcom. Because, you know, some of these small caps can move quite a bit. In fact, the wrong star. Let's have a look. 2.375 I've got here. So it's a little bit... 2.25. 2.5 is the share price. So a little bit below that. So market cap is 3.4. Share price 2.5. What revenue and profit or loss did the company generate? Revenue for the year is $5.1 million. Last year was $5 million. Gross margin 40%. Last year, 2014, was 50%. Loss for the period significantly reduced to $1.8 million from $2.8 million last year. Overheads reduced by 27%. I like the detail there. Thank you, Sierra. How much cash or debt does the company have? Not sure on cash, but placing only just happened, and new contracts are in advanced discussion stage, according to RNS. I believe there is no debt. Note the reduction in costs over the last year, despite increasing revenue. List three reasons why you think this company has potential. The share price was pulled down due to a low price level by YA Global in recent months. They are now gone. They've sold out their holding there. Placing has been gone a month ago, so cash is fine. Directors insist it took a majority of this placing themselves. So number two, board of directors own 50% of all shares in issue. Milton own institution own nearly 10%. So free float is around about 40% of that already small. So 136 million, you can do the math there. So 50% board of directors, institutional investors, 10%, so it's a very small free float. Number three, new line of products only just released, including branching out into air cargo, large new contracts being discussed according to the recent RNS and info from recent roadshow. Collaboration deal agreed with Sato, allowing them to move into North America market imminently. So that's Starcom. And be sure you get the right one. I just typed one in there and it came up the wrong one. So STAR, Starcom. But around about just less than 2.5 pence. Listen, do your own research on these stocks. This is just a suggestion. Everything you hear on this podcast is an idea, an investment idea. That's all it is. It's up to you whether to decide that idea is any good or not. All right, and that's it takes a while. It's a trade. Investing is a trade. It takes a long time to get right. And in fact, not always then. It's not how much right, it's how little wrong you can be. So thank you for getting involved there. And over to my five-star rater. And this is, listen to this. The title of this is Genius at Work, 5 stars. I think you're over-egging the old pud there, but I do appreciate that. It's by Amites. Anyway, wow, this podcast is simply the best. Get Tina Turner out, you guys. And it's helped me to really understand the market dynamics, to keep my head around AIM. Justin has a great format. Thank you very much. Check out my format, guys. And easy to listen to. Managed to make some smart money thanks to his tips and tricks. Simply the best. That's where I end my singing. Thanks very much. And I do appreciate that because, like I said, any review I get, if you listen to this podcast, it's for free. Any value you get from this, if you can leave a review, and that helps in the search for this podcast, and it gets higher up the charts, and more people can listen to it. So, you know, by giving your review there, you will help other people hopefully find the podcast as valuable as you do. So, I appreciate that. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
People in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy anything based solely on tip or recommendation you hear. Please do your own research.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.